Welcome back to Spirit Mornings here at Spirit Catholic Radio. I'm Bruce McGregor. She is
Chris McGregor.
Joined in studio today by Omar Gutierrez from the Faith Formation Office, Coordinator of Lay Leadership and Social Witness Formation.
Good morning.
Yeah.
We are tremendously blessed to have you with us, Omar.
Oh, thank you.
Because this is extreme adult faith formation. The Vatican decided to do all kinds of stuff this week.
Yeah, that's right.
So how exciting.
Bishops left and right. And yeah.
Oh, they've just appointed a new bishop to replace Bishop Ricken.
In Cheyenne.
Yeah, that just came out yesterday.
They've been, that seat's been vacant for a long time. God bless those folks, yeah.
Yeah, so I'm in all over the place. So they've been busy in that area. Mm-hmm. And the news just came out this morning. We were just reading from Zenith that the compendium for the Eucharist that has been promised, it's essentially the texts that are from the Catechism, that it will help explain the Roman Missal, explanation prayers, bring a lot of clarity to how we celebrate the Eucharist and what it means to us in our spiritual life, that's coming out.
That rocks the free world. That's just awesome.
It is. Yeah. I mean, that is going to be awesome. As you said, awesome. I'll steal your word. But we wanted to talk today because I think we're just beginning. It's one of those mustard seeds that all of a sudden is just exploding into this giant, gorgeous bush of information because of the, help me out, apostolic
constitution,
because there's several different types of apostolic decrees.
Decrees or exhortations. This is an apostolic constitution. That hasn't come out yet. That should has to be said. It hasn't come out yet. There was an announcement on October 20th this week that there will be an apostolic constitution coming out. Now, an apostolic constitution is different from an encyclical. An encyclical is more authoritative, but encyclicals tend to be more theological dissertation on a particular topic. An apostolic constitution is more of a legal document proclaiming something is, according to canon law, or is now going to be the practice of the Roman Catholic Church. So, for example, something like Ex Corde Ecclesia on the universities, that was an apostolic constitution, or Fidei Depositum on the catechism that came out in 1992, that was an apostolic constitution saying, this is now the catechism for the Catholic Church. So, coming up shortly will be this apostolic constitution on what the Catholic Roman Catholic Church is going to do to try to help traditional Anglicans come into the fullness of Christianity and in relation with the Pope.
Yeah, and we're going to break this open even more in our next half hour and what that means. But in a nutshell, what the world is beginning to appreciate is that this is a huge step in the Christian unity that we have been praying for not more than decades, more than centuries, almost a millennium.
Yeah,
I mean, it is, it's huge. And when I say a millennium, it has ramifications for the Orthodox Church, there was the Great Schism in the
1054.
Boy, you know everything, Omar. I love it. But in 1054, because as T. Scott was just talking on the news, the Bulgarian Orthodox Church has now approached, and actually face-to-face with Pope Benedict at the recent audience, said, we're looking for unity too.
Yes.
And they are working very diligently now in prayer and discernment. And this particular apostolic constitution, what they are now beginning to understand about it, is that this opens a pathway for the unity not only of the Anglican Church, those traditional Anglicans that want to come into full communion, but also potentially for Orthodox and other sacramental based type of religious offshoots.
Right. Churches are ecclesial communions. At the Second Vatican Council, when it talked about Christian unity and the document on ecumenism, the Second Vatican Council talked about looking at these other groups as churches, as legitimate churches, and as ecclesial communions, and starting that dialogue with them to try to get them, try to bring about this unity that Christ obviously wants and clearly wants and has said he wanted. So this step, which is unprecedented, is different from, now again, the Constitution hasn't come out yet, but we think that what it is, it's going to be it's called a personal ordinariate. which is something new. It's similar to the kind of structures that we would have for military chaplains, you know, who don't belong to a particular diocese. It's also kind of similar to the personal prelature that Opus Dei has. Mm-hmm. But it's different from all those things. And exactly how that's going to play out in canon law, we're not quite sure. But it's pretty exciting because it's a huge step forward. This is what I did talk to the Archbishop a little bit about this yesterday, and one of the things the Archbishop mentioned was that this is exactly what the Holy Father is supposed to be doing, building bridges. He's called one of the titles of the Pope is the Pontifex Maximus, and that's a fancy Latin way of saying the bridge builder. This is a great bridge being built for the sake of these folks who by the way, they're the ones who asked for this. Mm-hmm. The announcement that came out from the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith made the point that this is a response to a request, many requests over several years, to try to do something with this community.
It's great. I mean, Catholics, as we really begin to understand our faith and what's happening out in the world, you know, for many, many years, my grandmother and my grandmother's grandmother and everyone has been praying for Christian unity.
Yeah, that's right.
And here, what's occurred this week, do we appreciate... Wow, the little mustard seed that has been planted that is exploding into this beautiful bush where all these wonderful birds will gather and are welcoming and will be feeding. And it's just, it's wonderful.
It is. It's for me, it was such a great example of what our Holy Father has been talking about for years, by the way. He's been talking about reaching out and trying to bring this unity about for many, many years when he was the head of the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith, and even when he was just, you know, a father many years ago. One of the things that struck me as soon as I heard this news was when he was Father Ratzinger, right after the end of the Second Vatican Council, he came out with a book called The Theological Highlights of Vatican II. And in that book, he talks about how there was a Protestant professor, Schlink was his name, who talked about how when Roman Catholics talk about conversion and ecumenism and unity, they have to keep in mind that we're not in the 16th century anymore, that these Protestant groups have their own traditions, have their own spirituality now, have their own liturgies. They've been around for a long time, and you have to recognize the fact that when we don't want to be just absorbed by the Roman Catholic Church. We want to be able to still maintain something of our traditions. And back then, Father Ratzinger said that was a very good point, that we have to, as Catholics, realize that they're, insofar as their traditions are true, insofar as the traditions match up with Catholic doctrine, they should be allowed. They have a right to keep some of those traditions. And even in the Second Vatican Council document on ecumenism, it says about the Anglicans specifically that they hold a special place because of their link with the traditions of the Catholic Church, because some of their liturgical practices are really quite ancient.
They really are. And the break came with the Anglican Church with its connections to the bishops. It wasn't so much the understanding of the Eucharist or any other type of sacramental understanding, but it dealt with holy orders, and it was a political maneuver on the monarchy to take control of the structure which had the hearts of the people.
Right.
So, and, you know, this is going to have, I can imagine friends of ours, Joseph Pierce, who has done the wonderful The Quest for Shakespeare, and those particular folks who came into the church through from the Anglican tradition, that, you know, whether it's Joseph Pierce or Father George Rutler, I mean, there's a whole host. And going back to their spiritual father in many ways, John Cardinal Newman.
Yes, yeah.
Who I'm sure through his intercessory prayer,
no doubt,
in so many ways that this is
he's
going to
be blessed, Newman, in 2011.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. That this is a significant event, this coming back in. Now, what are the particulars that will, I mean, it's not unlike, we have different rites in the church. I know for Catholics, you know, the Malachite rite, and there's a Byzantine rite. And
sure, Ruthenian, and all sorts of rites. I was teaching a class on Wednesday, and I was telling this to my students then, that there are something like 32, 33 different rites within the Catholic Church. The most well-known, and of course the largest, is the Roman Catholic Rite, the Latin Rite, which you and I belong to. But there are so many other rites that are particular to different geographical regions. And those other rites have their own canon law, have a lot of their own sort of organizational structures, have their own liturgies. The Ruthenians, for instance, from the Ukraine, they practice their liturgy in Old Slavic, and the Egyptians, and all the rest. So there are all kinds of different rites. It's nothing new to have a different kind of Catholic with their own liturgy and with their own sort of legal structure. That's not new. This is important because this is in the West. Okay, we're talking about England, the source of Anglicanism, and this is a sort of a Western Protestant denomination that came out after the Reformation. So this is that's how it's different. That's why this is really quite unique and earth-shattering, because it's this first great, I shouldn't say the first, but it is a great step forward in opening up a pathway for folks who are, again, this is coming from them. They're looking to come into a greater union with the Catholic Church.
Yeah, it potentially there could be, because of their seeking, entire, not just parishes coming in, not just individuals, but parishes, as well as potentially dioceses.
Yes.
Coming into union with the Roman Catholic Church.
Exactly.
And they could potentially, I mean, their bishops would maintain their own bishops, not unlike, you know, different rites within our church, where they would, you might have seen that when, for example, Pope John Paul's funeral, or when the Holy Father was lifted up and brought forth and became the Holy Father, became the Pope.
Yeah.
You saw in those celebrations bishops from around the world. Some had, you could even, in their liturgical garb,
exactly,
you know,
yeah.
You could see that there was a difference. Those bishops would be, they would ultimately an allegiance to the Holy Father, yet their people would be, whether there might be some in our diocese in particular, mm-hmm. that while Archbishop Lucas is their archbishop, is our archbishop under the Latin rite,
right.
Say, for example, a Malachite rite, is their the Malachite bishop is their bishop.
Exactly, yeah. And there are other precedences for this as well. One of the things that struck me was a few years ago, a number of months ago, there was the big controversy of the Holy Father lifting the excommunication from the Society of St. Pius X bishops. And that, too, is an effort of the Holy Father to try to bring the members of that schismatic community into the fold. But before this happened, in Brazil, there was a community of traditional Latin rite, Tridentine rite, if you will, Catholics, who had a petition to regularize their relationship with Rome. And back then, the Holy Father decided that he was going to try to create for them a kind of personal diocese just for them, with their own structure, etc. So this is something that the Holy Father has been trying to do for a long time, and it's what a great commitment this is for real unity. And trying to bring everybody under the fold and in relationship with the Holy Father.
And what it does is, and I'm going to try to approach this real carefully, sometimes in ecumenical circles, there was a feeling that, quote-unquote, compromise needs to occur in our dialogue.
Right.
And compromise is something that, when you're dealing with truth, as we understand it, is something that you don't do.
Right.
I mean, compromise, not that compromise is a bad word in and of itself.
No.
But when it comes to truth, there are some things you don't compromise. I mean, whether the value of the of life, of the of our doctrinal issues, the importance of the sacraments, mm-hmm. there are certain things that you would not want to ever even consider compromising on.
Sure.
So this allows for this dialogue. Isn't this interesting that this would be an opening that we would not have to go down that road?
Right, and that's one of some of the commentaries about what this apostolic constitution might look like. Have mentioned the fact that this is a great step forward for ecumenism in general, because some of these persons in the traditional Anglican communion who have thought about coming into the Catholic Church have refrained from doing so because members of their own communion thought it would be an impediment towards ecumenism, as though having them become Roman Catholic would get in the way of bringing the rest of the Anglican communion into fullness of the relationship with Rome. And so this revolutionizes firms up the real purpose of what ecumenism is, which is a union of doctrine. Now there can be compromises in language and expression and emphases and those sorts of things, but when it comes to the truth, you know, did Jesus really mean this was his body and blood?
Mm-hmm.
Not just a symbol, but really his body and blood. Did Jesus really institute seven sacraments? Did Jesus really want there to be a vicar in Rome? These sorts of things, there shouldn't be compromise on, and these are the sorts of things which, as this apostolic constitution gets laid out, and as these individuals or parishes or dioceses maybe are looking to regularize their relationship, these are the sort of things that they'll be talking about with the Pope. And that is true dialogue. That is really, you know, what we want to do. But it seems like almost like for the first time for a long time, the church is finally saying, well, here's the door.
You call yourself Catholic.
Yeah.
Come on in.
Come on in. Yeah.
Catholics come home.
That's right. Catholics come home. Absolutely.
Well, and what's extraordinary about this is that this particular structure that the Holy Spirit has broken open for us, has presented to the children of God as a way for this to happen, is also potentially a structure in which other Catholics,
yeah.
I want to say that the universe can come back in, and most pointedly, the Orthodox.
Yeah,
and that when we talk about the Orthodox, we're talking about the Greek Orthodox, the Byzantine Orthodox,
Orthodox.
I mean, all when you see that on as identified as their name,
mm-hmm,
okay, because there are Greek, there are Byzantine Catholics, and there's the Byzantine Orthodox Catholics.
Right. Yes.
Those who separated from that union with Rome, with us, the Latin Rite, or the Roman Catholic Church,
right,
are those who have the Orthodox moniker on their name.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
I'm trying to. I'm not. I don't want to trivialize the importance of naming, because
exactly,
that identifies who we are.
Exactly.
But those Orthodox now, as we heard in the news today, the Bulgarian Orthodox mm-hmm. Church, the bishop of the church, has face-to-face with the Holy Father on Wednesday after the audience, said, we're excited about the potential for unity.
Yes. Yeah.
And we want to be able, and this new structure under this new constitution might be able to provide that.
Right. And there has been a fear and a pain, really, both in the part of the Anglicans and in the part of the Orthodox, certainly in the part of the Anglicans, and let's be honest, the Anglican Church, the Episcopalian Anglican Church, has had a lot of changes over the most recent years. And that's left a lot of the more traditionally minded Anglicans within their communion kind of lost, and there's a great deal of pain and suffering on their part, and amongst the Orthodox as well. The Orthodox are persecuted as Christians just as much as the Christians are, the Roman Catholic Christians are, in the Middle East and elsewhere, in Turkey, etc., and in Greece as well. So there's a lot of pain, there's a lot of suffering out there, and more and more we're starting to understand that we can trust each other. I remember Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who died just a little over a year ago. He had one time a meeting with John Paul II, and these two great minds, great artists, great thinkers came together, and Solzhenitsyn was actually convinced that the Roman Catholic Church was going to try to convert all the Russian Orthodox to Roman Catholicism, and they had to give up their language and give up their liturgy and be Roman Catholic and worship in Latin. That was the real fear that they had. Mm-hmm. And what this move does, what the Holy Father's really communicated to everybody is, no, we don't want to absorb you. You know, if you ever watched the Star Trek, like the Borg or something.
Right.
We want to let you be who you are, really Catholic, but in union with me, your vicar, the representative of Christ here, your father, your holy father. And that's a wonderful statement. It's a gigantic statement of unity and solidarity for the whole world.
Yeah, it's great times.
Yeah.
We're going to be pondering this in our hearts. I mean, Our Lady must just be filled with...
I have to mention, did you know that the relics of St. Therese of Lisieux were in England this past summer? They were in York this past summer, and people flocked from all over England to come to this, and it was an Anglican cathedral. Okay, it wasn't a Catholic cathedral. Mm-hmm. It was an Anglican cathedral. St. Therese of Lisieux, on her feast day, they were there at this cathedral, and people flocked from all over England to come and see and be with the relics of St. Therese of Lisieux. If you don't think that's had some kind of role, then you should rethink the way you view the saint. So that's fantastic. Yeah.
It is extraordinary times.
Yeah.
I mean, this is stuff that we should be pondering in our hearts right along with Our Lady. I mean, this is how it gets done.
Yeah.
You know, miraculous things happen sometimes. I mean, you go back to 1989. Who would have thought a wall would come down from Berlin?
Yeah.
The people would be taking it apart, and it wouldn't be blown apart.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right.
You know, and this is another one of those moments in church history where you'll look back on October 20th, 2009, as a significant day.
I think it will be, yeah.
Because it, hopefully the walls, those barriers, those blocks. It wasn't so much about the sacrament. Theologies would grow from that separation, but the initial breaks generally came because of that connection with Rome, with the Holy Father, and only because, don't forget, in the context of history, when those things happened, there wasn't the type of communication and the ability to be able to dialogue these things through before the breaks happened.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
You know, because there was a separation, because there wasn't computers and telephones and pick up and say, let's get together, let's hop on the plane, and let's meet face to face. They couldn't do that. So a lot of these breaks, like in particular what happened with the Orthodox in 1054, but also what would happen, you know, in the Protestant Reformation, there was never the ability to sit down and to pray together in that response. Before the tensions would come in, and then
and
the
politics
splits would
gets
come.
Involved. Yeah, sure.
Exactly. And so maybe this is the time, and all of our prayers, we have to continue to pray.
Yeah, the great Anglo-Catholic, and this is a term they use for themselves, Anglo-Catholics. One of the great Anglo-Catholics was C.S. Lewis.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine good Clive Staples, Jack Lewis. Hopefully he's in heaven, no doubt, and I imagine he's very, very happy about this news as well. But I remember
his great friend J.R. Tolkien,
Tolkien,
the Roman Catholic,
exactly. And I remember I was reading The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe to my son recently, and there's that line where the four kids, they're there and they're with the Beaver family, and Mr. Beaver says, you know, Aslan is on the move. Aslan is on the move, and there was a hush in the room. Even though the kids had never heard about Aslan, they knew this was important. And when I was reading it to my son, and as this news came out, I really got a sense that, yeah, Aslan is on the move. Jesus is on the move. The Holy Spirit is on the move. Things are having an exciting time to be Catholic. It's a wonderful time to be Catholic, and we should all rejoice at the possibilities that this new olive branch that the Holy Father is putting forward offers us.
Catholics, come home.
That's right.
Catholics, come home. And you, again, just real briefly, and we're going to have him in the studios again next Friday, Archbishop George Lucas. You had the opportunity to speak with him on the phone, and he had some thoughts he wanted conveyed.
Yeah, just that this is exactly what the Holy Father should be doing, being a Pontifex Maximus, this bridge builder. And this dialogue has been going on for decades. Obviously, the secular media is going to sort of focus in on, you know, married priests, because Anglican priests are allowed to be married, and it seems as though that we'll still allow those priests to be married if they come into the Catholic Church. But the fact of the matter is that we've been having Anglican priests who've converted, married Anglican priests who've converted, we've allowed them to become Catholic priests as well. So it's not that innovation, it's not the most important part of this, although that's probably what the secular media is going to focus in on.
And just a quick footnote, too. The ramifications for the continent of Africa.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, there are 37 million Anglicans in Africa. 37, more than anywhere else in the world, by the way. Mm. And they tend to be more traditional.
Bishop Desmond Tutu being
he's a famous
very notable
one. Yeah. And they tend to be more traditional. And so some are speculating that we could see many, 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 maybe hundreds of thousands. And you know, we don't know. We'll have to see what the details of this apostolic constitution look like. But there could be as many as hundreds of thousands of African Anglicans coming into the Catholic Church.
just last year. Was it this year? Last year, the Holy Father was in Africa.
Yeah, the synod was just most recently this year.
Yeah, the synod was just recently, but boy, Our Lady. Oh, she must be pondering all these in her immaculate heart. I love it.
That's right.
Catholics, come home.
Amen.
From around the world.